Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, Mrs. Kennedy and me. Clint Hill is our guest. On November 11 of 1960, Clint Hill, Special Agent, United States Secret Service, who had just completed some time with the White House detail for President Dwight Eisenhower, was about to meet the wife of the newly elected President of the United States. He had been assigned to protect Jackie Kennedy, and he wasn't sure he was happy with that assignment. The book ends a year after the assassination of President Kennedy, Jackie Kennedy throwing a surprise farewell party for Clint Hill in her office, presenting him with a black three-ring binder filled with photos that chronicled their 4 years together. And those were some 4 years. The title page said, "The Travels of Clint Hill." We'll go on those travels with Clint Hill this hour of the program. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I must tell you, and probably Clint, that I read every single sentence of this book, partially because of my family background, and that affects us in many ways, Irish Catholic family. And I was alive during the assassination, and it made a huge impact on me, as did that whole decade. So it was hard to read this book without crying, because it all comes back. And it was very, very hard, as you can imagine, for Clint Hill, who held all of this close to his chest for years and years and years, because it was just simply too painful to talk about. The book is written with a great deal of respect for Jackie Kennedy. It is not a sensational book. It is a moving book, and I'm glad that he wrote it. Clint, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you. I really am glad. I can understand how difficult it was. I can't understand how difficult it was for you to live with this, because you saw ultimate horrors, but I'm so glad you wrote the book, because it is written beautifully, and it really sheds light on the presidency that we haven't had before. So I'm saying, I know it was hard to write, but I'm really glad you wrote it.
Well, thank you. It was very difficult to relive some of those memories, but it was cathartic for me to do so, and ended up being beneficial to me emotionally.
Good. I'm glad. Well, let's not start with the end. We'll get to that eventually, because things must end. Let's start even before the beginning of the book. You had been on the White House detail for Dwight Eisenhower and had been able to travel much of the world with him, hadn't you?
Yes, we had. We traveled all through Europe, through South America, and through Southeast Asia. I've been to many, many countries, and I really enjoyed the experience. And I was looking forward to continuing that during the new administration when President Kennedy was elected.
And you were assigned to the First Lady, and I'm sure your thoughts were, wait a second, I thought I was going to be protecting the president.
That's correct. I was very, very disappointed, upset. I knew I had to accept the assignment, but I didn't like it, because I knew that from past history, First Ladies were very inactive. And they participated in fashion shows, and tea parties, and ballets, things of that nature. And I wanted to be where the action was, which was with the president.
Mm-hmm. And yet you found her over time to be a phenomenally intelligent woman, a very kind woman, too. The two of you had a relationship of very deep respect, and you really were captivated by her, as we soon found out everybody in the world was.
Yes, I was. Over time, we became very close. I had great admiration and respect for her, and she trusted me. And so we got along very, very well throughout that entire period of time.
Mm-hmm. You were able, again, to travel in many parts of the world. There are some stories that I want you to be sure to tell. I love the story when she had to entertain with a state dinner for the president of Pakistan, which she had this great sense of history and of drama and of throwing the right kind of party, which she decided to have at Mount Vernon, of all places.
Yes, it all developed because we had been to France, and the French government had thrown a party at Versailles, a big dinner for President, Mrs. Kennedy, and she saw how that was handled. It was a venue that was away from the presidential residence. And so when we came back to the States and she was going to plan this dinner for President Ayub Khan of Pakistan, she decided she wanted to do something similar, to have a venue away from the White House and very historical in nature, and that would be Mount Vernon. And so plans were made for the state dinner to be held at Mount Vernon. It was very complicated.
And it also, I love this story, there was a rainstorm, so there were a lot of mosquitoes at Mount Vernon, and you had spraying of the mosquitoes going on at the same time that the food had arrived, and so who had to eat the food to test it to make sure nobody was going to get sick?
Well, it rained, so they sprayed for mosquitoes when the rain quit, and when Rene Burdon, who was the White House chef, saw that, he was afraid that his food that he had prepared and had been transported from the White House to Mount Vernon would be tainted or damaged in such a way that people might get sick. He really went berserk on them. And the social secretary, Tish Baldries, came up with an idea that, well, look, let's have a couple agents taste the food and test it. If they don't die, we're safe.
Great.
And that was not very good for the agents, but we selected two agents to taste the food. They did so. They got a little sick because they had to eat so much, but didn't suffer from any serious damage. And we went out. The dinner went on as planned. Everybody had a wonderful time.
They probably liked having a chance to have the food, even though they were taking some risk. There is a theme in your book of your never being able to have time to eat anything. Plus, you didn't get very much money for your per day expenses. You guys were living on the cheap.
Well, yes, we weren't in it for the money. Our salaries were very low. We started out about $4,980 a year. That's a little over $400 a month.
Huh.
And when we traveled, we were given an expense account of $12 per day, which was to cover our room, our board, our dry cleaning, our laundry, whatever expenses we had. That was to be covered by that $12. And then we usually worked so many hours without being paid overtime to start with. And then we didn't have time to eat, so most of us carried a sack of peanuts or something in our pocket just to tide us over until we did have that opportunity.
I bet those were the days when they had peanuts on airplanes, huh?
They had them on airplanes, and we tried to get the packages in our pocket as much as possible. And it was very, very cost-efficient to do it that way, I guess, but it wasn't very healthy.
There are times, she soon realizes, and you probably knew it before she did, that the world was captivated by her and listened to what she had to say. I was impressed by the fact that she spoke several languages quite fluently and could really conduct pretty detailed conversations with President de Gaulle when she had to speak to the Bay of Pigs survivors. She spoke to them in Spanish. She really was helpful politically because of her knowledge of foreign languages.
That's very definitely true. She captivated audiences with her ability to speak in their native tongue, such as in France. She talked to de Gaulle. De Gaulle turned to her at one point and said he wished that the people of France were as well-versed and educated in French history as she was, because she knew French history very well, having spent considerable time in France. She was very, very effective when we traveled to places like South America. We were down in Venezuela, Mexico City, down to Puerto Rico. So her ability to speak French or Spanish was beneficial to the president.
Mm-hmm. What was it about her, do you think? And you were with this woman for 4 years. You were protecting her life for 4 years. What was it about her? Was it the intelligence? Was it her beauty? Was it her sense of fashion that made all of these people all over the world come out to see her and applaud her? I mean, we're not just talking a few people, thousands and thousands in very remote parts of the world.
Well, it was all those things combined, plus an appreciation for the things that were right in front of you on a local level, wherever it was, whether it be India, Pakistan, any place else that we visited. And she wanted to converse with the people, which she did. She wanted to see things that involved the people themselves, which we did. And she just wanted to be very well informed about everything that the local populace did, what their interests were. And she expressed that interest to them, and they appreciated it very much.
Was she irked that you had to find out what she was up to? Did she really want to be a free spirit and do things on her own? And how did you handle that, her need to be somewhat of a free spirit and your need to protect the First Lady?
Well, that was my job, was to create an environment where she could do whatever it was she wanted to do without jeopardizing her safety. And so that was what I had to keep in mind all the time. And I was able to do it, fortunately, and provide her with opportunities, whether it be to go horseback riding, water ski, to play tennis, to be with friends. It didn't matter. I tried to make sure that she was able to do that and do it in a safe and very private manner. She was a very private person. She loved to get away, and just she and the children and the president and maybe a few friends, but avoiding the press and the general populace as much as possible so they could have some family time together.
Did you ever learn to play tennis?
I was not very good at playing tennis. He got me on the tennis court for the first time in my business suit and my wartime shoes, and I proved to be less than worthy in playing.
It tells a story of when you were wearing your Florsheim shoes and the president had this idea that we were all, and it was true, you know, the time we got to be physically fit. We're getting fat. We're watching television. Whereas they had this family that was doing physical exercise every single day. You had to go on, was it a 50-mile hike? And you didn't have the right shoes.
Yeah, that's right. The president had challenged the military to improve their physical condition and prove it by going on long hikes. 50 miles was what was determined to be the right distance. And it all developed from something that happened way back in Teddy Roosevelt's time when he challenged the Marine Corps in that manner. And so now President Kennedy challenged the military and his staff, and some people participated. On one occasion, his brother-in-law, the Prince Stanislaus Radziwill, who was a Polish prince, and his best friend, Chuck Spalding, decided they were going to take up the challenge. Trouble is, they were in Florida, and President and Mrs. Kennedy decided that they wanted to go out and check on them periodically, and they said they knew the Secret Service needed an agent out there to advance their arrival, and they wanted that to be me. So I had to go on a 50-mile hike. I had not prepared at all. I had no idea this was going to happen. The best thing I had was a pair of Florsheim wingtip shoes. So I wore them. I did finally discover I had some blisters at the end, but they managed to hold up very well, and I managed to finish the 50-mile hike.
Was that the time, I'm trying to remember, was that the time the president gave you a medal that he had put together himself?
Yes, at the conclusion when we got back to Palm Beach, the president asked me to come into the residence where they're having a small party. And he presented me with a medal made out of construction paper that he and Mrs. Kennedy had made with a chain made out of crepe paper that they hung around my neck. And it said, for Dazzle, February 23rd, 1963, the Order of the Pacemaker. And it was in honor of making it 50 miles. It still is one of my favorite memento.
Oh, and Dazzle was your Secret Service nickname? Code name?
That was my code name, yes.
Uh-huh.
Don't ask me why, because I don't know why.
You must have dazzled people, Clint.
I don't know. They gave us all code names, and that was mine.
Yeah. It must have been a very hard life for you to lead just personally, too, because you were married, you had a child, and the second child came while you were protecting the First Lady. It was, you had to sacrifice so much on a personal level to do this work, didn't you?
Well, I was gone between 80% and 90% of the time.
Wow.
I was able to take Mrs. Kennedy out to dinner and do those things she wanted to do. I couldn't do that for my own wife or family. My children grew up pretty much without a father, but I was always there for John and Caroline, so it was very difficult, to say the least.
Yeah. How did you reconcile that?
I really didn't. Just didn't. It was a job I had to do, and I did it willingly. I suffered the consequences eventually. And now my two sons and I are probably closer than ever.
Oh.
My wife and I are no longer together, but my sons and I are closer than ever.
Have they read your book?
I haven't asked. I've been on the road all the time, and
I haven't asked whether
or not they have. I presume they have.
Yeah, I hope they have. It'll teach them a whole lot about your character as well. You talk about John and Caroline. You were there in the hospital when John was born. You were there in the hospital when news was received that the tiny baby Patrick had died.
Yes, I was there when John was born in at Georgetown Hospital in Washington, and then in Hyannis, Port Mass, at Otis Air Force Base when young Patrick was born, and then unfortunately Patrick died 2 days later.
Yeah. What a year that was for her. Oh, my gosh. You get to 1963 and you think, when you're reading the book, I don't know if I can read this or not. And you lived through it. You know, the death of a baby and then what happened in November. Oh, my gosh. It's this enormous tragedy, isn't it, Clint, that everybody experienced. But you and Jackie Kennedy experienced it in a way that it's hard for any of us to imagine the impact that had on your mind and on your heart.
It was a very, very difficult year. It started out well, but obviously it ended tragically in August, September, October, and November.
Yeah. We're going to continue our conversation with Clint Hill in just a moment. Clint is author of Mrs. Kennedy and Me, which I noticed this week has made it to the New York Times bestseller list, Special Agent, United States Secret Service. And he writes in great detail and really very lovingly and informatively about his years as Special Agent, United States Secret Service, who was protecting Jackie Kennedy. He started his assignment on November 11 of 1960, and he stayed on for a year. Lyndon Johnson gave Jackie Kennedy and her family Secret Service protection for a year after the assassination. The part of the book, of course, that's been receiving a great deal of attention is the day of the assassination, and I can't imagine what that day was like for Clint Hill. It was absolutely horrendous, and he writes about that. But he also writes about these wonderful gatherings at Hyannis Port and Jackie Kennedy's we got to talk about the horse story, being given a horse. What the heck do you do with a horse that's given to you in Pakistan? And it's a beautiful horse. The tragedies that she had to deal with, her relationship with Ambassador Kennedy, which we'll talk about, her relationship with her husband. It's for those of you who are can't get enough about reading about the Kennedys, you will like this book. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page, if you'd like to leave comments there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clint Hill is our guest. His book is Mrs. Kennedy and Me. He is a former United States Secret Service agent who was in the presidential motorcade during the John F. Kennedy assassination. He writes about that, but most of the book is details of trips he took all over the world with Jackie Kennedy, time spent at Hyannis Port, time spent protecting her while she was riding horses and water skiing, which she loved, and being with her children. We welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. And let's start with our calls with Joan in Madison. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I was wondering if Mr. Hill had maintained a relationship with Caroline or John after his detail was done, and even after Mrs. Kennedy passed away, if he was able to maintain a relationship with the family at all.
Clint, did you hear that?
Yes, I did. My last contact with Caroline was last October. We were invited to come to the library in Boston, where Caroline released the recordings of her mother and had a discussion about it that evening. And we had a private dinner with Caroline and the members of the group that did the recordings, and I mentioned talking to her about the book at that time. She's a wonderful young lady. We have a good relationship, and I can't say enough good things about her. She's a great, fine young lady.
Mm-hmm. And you could see, it's interesting how we can see signs of what may happen to somebody, not the tragedies, but what interests them. I was interested in how early on young John was interested in helicopters and his dad's return on a helicopter and airplanes. I think several people said that he's going to be a pilot someday.
Well, including his mother. He had that interest from the time he was about 2 years of age. As soon as he saw the presidential helicopters, he was crazy about them. He wanted to ride on the helicopters every chance he got. And the president did make that possible. Whatever the president would fly to, from the White House to Andrews Air Force Base, getting Air Force One, many, many times, he would allow John to accompany him on that flight. And invariably, John would want to go with him on Air Force One, which he couldn't do because John had to go back to the White House. But John loved military, helicopters, airplanes, and it turned out that he became a pilot like his mother thought he would. Unfortunately, the end result was tragic.
Yes, it was.
Can...
Go ahead, Joan.
Oh, I just wanted to say thanks so much for the opportunity, and I look forward to getting the book.
I think you'll enjoy
it.
Thank you, Joan.
So much for calling.
Thank you. Jane in Oshkosh. Hi, Jane.
Hi, I just wanted to tell Agent Hill, I read his book. I'm a huge, huge fan of Jackie Kennedy, and the book is so respectful. I just can't thank you enough for putting her in a light as a human being and with a great deal of elegance. I did get a chance, by the way, to interview Bob Foster, who was John and Caroline's on their Secret Service detail, and it was the same thing, just incredible dignity that he gave to Mrs. Kennedy and the family. So thank you so much for this book.
Well, thank you. Glad you read it and glad you enjoyed it. Bob Foster was a wonderful agent. We worked together very closely.
Yeah. Thank you, Jane, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Why did you decide and when did you decide? I'm wondering if it was a long time ago that you thought you wanted to write this book and you just couldn't do it because of the ending of the book, or if you decided recently and why you made such a decision, Mr. Hill.
Well, I vowed that I would never write a book. I promised myself that. I had many, many offers. People came to me and wanted me to write books, wanted me to contribute to books, and I always said no. Then a friend of mine who was an agent, decided to write a book. And he started about 10 years ago putting information together. And he introduced me to a young lady named Lisa McTubbin. And she, over a period of time, gained my trust and my confidence in her. And she elicited a great deal of information from me. And she talked to me about my having information that was very historical in nature and really should be documented. And then I was talking to some former White House reporters who were friends of mine who had covered the Kennedys. And they said, you know, we were there, we covered the Kennedys, we were never permitted to interview Mrs. Kennedy, and we never knew her, but you did. Mm. And you owe it to the American people to document that period of time so that they really get to know her. And so I finally decided that's the appropriate thing to do, and I talked to Ms. McCubbin, and she agreed, and we decided to write the book.
Mm-hmm. And how hard was it for you? It was really hard for me to read the last part of the book. That day stays with me. It will forever. I saw the Kennedy grave and the everlasting flame for the first time last year in Washington, and I just started sobbing. I had the same response reading your book. It was the start of a horrible decade in this country, and it just shattered so many of us, and my gosh, it must have just really shattered you, Clint.
Well, it did. I call that period of time, there was 4 days there where the world actually stopped.
Yes.
For all intents and purposes. I call that the end of the age of innocence,
mm-hmm.
And that's really what it was. And it affected me a great deal over a long period of time and still is affecting me today, so... It's something I'll always live with.
Yeah. She had some thoughts about not going to Dallas. I wasn't aware that she was concerned about Adlai Stevenson's reception in Florida, and she mentioned that to you. Can you talk about that?
Well, she when we came back from Greece, she told me she was planning to go on this trip to Texas. And then she had a dinner party one evening, and Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. and his wife were there. And prior to that, Adlai Stevens had been in Dallas, and he had had a confrontation with some people, and they had spit on him and given him a very bad time. And FDR Jr. and his wife recommended Mrs. Kennedy during that dinner that she not go to Texas because it was things were too volatile down there, that it was just looking for trouble. So she came to me and asked me about it. And I told her we did not have any intelligence information that would indicate there was going to be any more of a problem in Dallas than there was any other place in the South. That I didn't think that the situation regarding Adlai Stevenson would be duplicated in the case of President and Mrs. Kennedy. And I recommended that she go. And so she, based on my recommendation, she decided that, yes, she would have copied the president. Mm.
And does that play around in your mind? Do you wish you had told her not to go? Do you worry about that or not that?
No, I really don't, because at least she had those last 24 to 48 hours with her husband prior to his death.
Mm.
If she had not gone, I think it would have been much more difficult for her.
Yeah. And those are such moving parts of the book, because you knew she was late for breakfast. He wanted her to be at breakfast, and he was a little irritated that she wasn't there. But once she got there, everybody loved her so much. She was charming. But you lay out in great detail, and those of us who are alive then will forever remember exactly what she wore and how that day ended with what she had on. But you were there seeing the pillbox hat being put on and the clothing being put on before it was spattered with blood.
That's true. Her schedule that morning in Fort Worth indicated that she wasn't going to go to the breakfast. But the president, when he got down there, wanted her to attend, and so he called up to the room, and I answered the phone, and he had asked an agent to make the call, and the agent told me that the president wanted me to bring her down there right away. And so I convinced her that that's what should be done. And down we went to the breakfast, which she attended. There were 2,500 people in the room. They just gave her a thundering applause. The president made some quip about when he went to Paris, he was the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris, and he was getting the same feeling as we traveled around Texas. That one thing about it, nobody cares what Lyndon or I wear, but they certainly care what Mrs. Kennedy wore.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of a lighthearted breakfast, very nice, and we went from there to Air Force One and flew over to Love Field in Dallas.
Yeah. When did you know something horrible had happened, Clint?
Well, we had gone into the city of Dallas in the motorcade and had a wonderful reception from thousands of people along the way. It was very crowded. They gave them a very warm Texas reception. As we were turning left onto Elm Street, we had to slow down considerably because of the type of turn that it was. But we straightened out and we started to pick up a little speed. I was on the running board of the car immediately behind the presidential vehicle on the left-hand side, and I was scanning over some grassy area to the left. I heard an explosive noise from my right rear, in the rear of the motorcade, and my eyes then went toward that sound, and in so doing, I scanned across the back of the presidential car. I saw the president grab at his throat and move a little bit to his left. I knew he was in trouble, so I jumped from the follow-up car running board and ran toward the presidential vehicle in an attempt to get up on top of the rear of the president's car to form a shield between President and Mrs. Kennedy and whoever was trying to do them harm.
Mm.
While I was running, apparently there was a second shot, which I did not hear. And just before I got to the car, a third shot rang out that hit the president in the upper right rear of the head.
And she was, this I'm afraid is a bit gruesome, but we have that famous picture, and it's in the book, and it's forever in our minds, of Jackie reaching across the trunk of the car, and you're climbing up on the trunk of the car. What was she doing, and what were you saying to her then?
Well, I didn't say anything, but she would came up on the trunk of the car to try to retrieve some of the material that came out of the president's head when he was when the shot hit him in the upper right rear of the head. Some of the bone fragments, blood, brain matter came out and went across the right rear of the trunk. And she was trying to grab some of that. She didn't even know I was there at the time. I got a hold of her, put her back in the seat. When I did that, the president's body fell into her lap.
Mm.
I could see the right side of his face was up. I could see his eyes were fixed. There was a hole in the upper right rear of his head. I could see into the brain was partly destroyed. Mm. And I assumed it was a fatal wound.
Yeah. And then you sped to the hospital, and your coat covered him, didn't it?
Well, when we got to the hospital, first we had to remove Governor Connally from the car because he was sitting in the jump seat immediately in front of the president. We couldn't move the president until we moved the governor, who had also been shot. When we got the governor out, we tried to move the president. Mrs. Kennedy held on to the body, wouldn't let go. And I recognized that the problem was she didn't want anybody to see the condition he was in because it was very, very gruesome.
Yeah.
So I took off my coat and covered his head and his upper back. When I did that, she let go, and we placed the president on a gurney and took him into the emergency room.
Can somebody who's a Secret Service agent, she was in shock, of course. You must have been in some shock, too. You certainly never anticipated anything like this happening during your line of duty. Did you feel shock, or were you so well trained that you knew that you just had to still look out for her?
Well, that was it. I had a job to do, and that was to take care of her. The adrenaline was flowing rapidly, I'm sure, and there wasn't any time to do anything else. She was in shock from the moment that the first shot hit the president right on through the time that we got up on Air Force One.
And you had to be on the phone with Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, I happened to be on the telephone from the emergency room, letting my office in Washington at the White House know, making sure that they were in touch with the presidential family. During that process, the operator cut in and said that the attorney general wanted to talk to me. He said, what's going on down there, Clint? And because he apparently had been advised by J. Edgar Hoover that there had been a shooting, but not much more than that. So he really didn't know the situation. He asked me what was going on down there. I explained the president had been shot, the governor had been shot, and we were in the emergency room at Parkland Hospital. So then he just said, well, how bad is it?
Mm.
And why he didn't think it was too bad. I did not want to tell him that his brother was dead.
So
I simply said, it's as bad as it can get. And then he hung up the phone. That's how he found out.
Mm. Let's go to Susie in Richfield. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I just want to say, first of all, I am so looking forward to reading your book. It is such a pleasure to see a book out that's written about someone of such importance in our world that's written with respect. And I also want to comment how moved I was at your 60 Minutes interview. My husband and I were both moved to tears, and I think one of the things that we forget is that our real heroes are people like you who are ready to do whatever it takes to make sure that's what is important in our country is there for all of us, and I thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for reading the book.
Thank you for the call, Susie. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@WPR.org. I was watching the retrospective of Mike Wallace's work on 60 Minutes the week before last, and there was an interview with you. I don't know if you saw that or not, Mr. Hill, but he was essentially saying to you, don't beat yourself up over this. It wasn't your fault. You couldn't have done anything. And I was left with the impression that you have felt that there was something more that you could have done, and you just carried that with you for years and years and years, Clint Hill. Is that right?
Well, that's true, and I still feel a sense of responsibility and somewhat of a sense of guilt, because the way the situation developed that day, I was the only agent there who had a chance to do anything. Everybody else was in the positions that they were in did not give them that opportunity. But from where I was situated, and from where the shots came, I was the only one who had a chance, and I failed.
Oh, but what could you have done? I mean, you couldn't have been in the car. They didn't want a Secret Service in the car. You couldn't have been there.
No, I understand that, but I just feel the sense that I should have gotten there a little faster. I should have done something, but I was unable to do so.
Yeah. You were able to stay with the Kennedy family for a year after the assassination. The other thing that stays in the national memory and will forever was how we were guided with great dignity through that whole period of mourning, through the time when, as you said, nothing happened in this country for 4 days. And she was able to, I guess you have to look to people to be strong. And a lot of people in this country looked at her. Here's a woman who had just lost a baby. She sees her husband assassinated. He's the president of the country. She did the funeral, and she carried the country.
Yes, she did. She was very brave, very stoic, and very dignified. And everybody in the country, I think, was very proud of her, and they should be.
Yeah.
She did an outstanding job on behalf of the country, on behalf of herself and the president.
And how did you hold it together?
Well, we didn't have a chance to do anything but hold it together, because we had nobody to replace us. There were only two of us assigned to Mrs. Kennedy during that entire period of time. We had assistance from other agents periodically, but basically it was from the time that she was up until she went to bed, we were on duty. And during that four-day period, I went with very little sleep, not complaining at all, because it was necessary. We just did what we had to do and did it willingly.
Mm-hmm. There was a time, this must have been quite a moment, when she called you, I believe, at midnight and said that she wanted to go to his grave. And you, I believe you drove, or I don't know who drove, but you went it after midnight with Bobby Kennedy and Jackie to the grave.
Yes, that was the night of the funeral, the 25th of November, which also was John Jr.'s third birthday.
Mm.
And she wanted to go and pay her respects to her husband, but also to see the eternal flame for the first time that night, alone, without any press or public there. And so that's what we did. We took Robert Kennedy over there, and they spent some time there kneeling and praying, and it was very touching.
I know that she and Bobby Kennedy spent time reading classical literature after the assassination to try and make some sense, if one ever can, about a tragedy so enormous. Did you do the same? Did you go to poetry? Did you read Aeschylus? What did you do?
I was so busy, I didn't have the opportunity to do any of those things.
Mm.
I was making arrangements for her to do the things that she needed to do, for the children to do the things that they needed to do. There was going to be a change of personnel insofar as the Secret Service is concerned, because we now had a new president to protect. And so it was a very busy and difficult time for all of us, and not just for me.
And what about subsequently, Clint Hill? What have you done to make some sense of what happened? Can you make sense of it or not?
Well, in 1990, I went back to Dallas. I wanted to be there and look at the area for my own well-being, and I spent considerable time in Dealey Plaza and up on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, and I came away after looking at that, considering the weather, the angles, the speed of the car, everything. Came away with the conclusion that I did everything I could that day, and the advantages all lay with the shooter. We didn't have any, and there wasn't much more than I could have done than what I already did.
Mm-hmm. Where were you when Oswald was killed?
Was in the White House. We were in the process of preparing to take the president's body from the East Room of the White House up to the U.S. Capitol to be placed in state. I heard a conversation between a couple of the domestic help there in the White House, and they said, well, excuse my French, but they said, I'm the son of a bitch, this was should have died, should have been killed. And I didn't know who they were talking about. I thought maybe they were talking about the president. I confronted them, and then they told me that they were talking about Lee Harvey Oswald, who had just been shot in Dallas. That's how I found out.
We welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of Mrs. Kennedy and Me, Clint Hill, Special Agent, United States Secret Service, on November 11 of 1960, begins his protection of Jackie Kennedy, a job that he has with the Secret Service for the next 4 years. Here's how you can reach us if you'd like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to send that, is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Jim in Wausau next. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Mr. Hill, thank you for your service. Could you please tell or your listeners about any military background that you had? My late father, all my uncles were in World War II, and how you got into the Secret Service. And I look forward to reading your book, and I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you. God bless you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much. When I finished college at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, I had an obligation to fulfill with the U.S. military because it was during the Korean War, and I entered the United States Army. They decided I should go to the Army Intelligence Center, and I was trained to be a special agent in the Counterintelligence Corps of the U.S. Army. I held that position for a period of 3 years. I liked the investigative work that I was involved in, and so I decided I wanted to make that type of work a career. I had some information about the Secret Service and knew some of the people involved. I wanted to join the Secret Service if possible. There were only 269 people in the Secret Service at that time worldwide, so it was very difficult to get in. Eventually, a spot did open up, and I was allowed to become a special agent in the United States Secret Service.
Hmm. Isn't it interesting to look at how your life began and what has happened to you throughout the course of your life? It's quite a it's quite a journey, isn't it?
Well, it was for me. I was born in North Dakota in a small town. I was placed in an orphanage shortly after my birth. Fortunately for me, I was adopted about 3 months later and had a wonderful family, a mother and father who really cared for me, and a wonderful sister that they had adopted previously. I grew up in a very small town in North Dakota called Washburn, North Dakota. 912 people lived there when I left there in 1950 to go to college.
Hmm.
But it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, it must have been. It's still it's amazing to think of what your assignment was, and I wonder if you can shed light on it in a way that we can understand. It's just such an interesting thing to spend 4 years with the most powerful family in the whole United States, you know, having meals with them and protecting them. Did you feel at some point that you were sort of a part of the family on any occasions, or are you always aware of what your job is? It's because that's a long period of time to be with a family and with a person, isn't it, Clint?
Well, it was a considerable period of time, but you're always aware of what your job is, and you're not a part of the family. You are there, and you are asked to participate occasionally in certain family events and affairs, but you always remember who you really are and who they are, and you don't allow yourself to become too involved in their personal relationships. You certainly don't want to ever believe that you're on the same level that they are. So we knew our place, and we tried to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the surprise farewell party that Jackie Kennedy threw for you, and the binder that she gave that had all the photos. The Travels of Clinton J. Hill.
Yes, that was in November of 1964, as I was about to return to the White House and go back on the White House detail. She and her secretary in New York, Nancy Tuckerman, who was a very good friend of Mrs. Kennedy's, and the staff members that they had there put together a little party in New York, and some of the agents that were there with me were also involved. And they had prepared a booklet of photographs depicting our travels and things that we had gone through during that four-year period. They also had made a large poster with the silhouette of a male wearing sunglasses. And since they thought I was going to be transferred back out into the field somewhere, the title on it was Muddy Gap, Wyoming Welcomes Its Newest Citizen. So it was a wonderful time. It was very gracious of them to do that, and I was very thankful. Mrs. Kennedy was very nice.
And you have been honored for your work. You were also invited by President Clinton to come to the White House again, weren't you?
Yes, that was in 1994. In fact, it happened the day that Mrs. Kennedy died. And he wanted to meet me and thank me for my service. And we discussed the Kennedy administration, Mrs. Kennedy, and the president. And then I got word that night that the Mrs. Kennedy had died. And subsequently, I went to the burial service for Mrs. Kennedy at Arlington National Cemetery in the presidential motorcade.
Hmm. She died so young, didn't she?
I beg your pardon?
She died very young.
Yes, she was. She was very young. She was 64. And it was very emotional for me to have that happen. I really miss her.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, man, there's so much to your story. We never got to the horse story, and maybe we should end on a little bit of humor and welcome maybe one more phone call, but... the trip to Pakistan was a great part of the book, and I love the fact she's given this gorgeous horse, and she loves horses, and you got to figure out, what the heck am I going to do with a present of a horse?
Yes, that was a problem. It was a beautiful gift from the President Ayub Khan of Pakistan and the people of Pakistan, beautiful horse named Sardar. And then my problem was, how are we going to get this horse back to the United States? Of course, at the same time, the people of India had given her two tiger cubs that also had to be brought back to the United States. So it was a complex problem. Fortunately, was solved with the assistance of the military and the State Department, and everything got back to the United States okay.
And she wrote a letter. Tell us about the letter she wrote to her husband. She wanted to get the horse out of quarantine.
Well, she didn't want the poor horse, as she called it, to be restricted in quarantine. She thought it had suffered enough for having to traveled all the way from Pakistan to the United States. Obviously, in her mind, could never have been anything wrong with that horse since it was a gift from President Ayub Khan. And she wrote, she had me send a cable to the president, who was in California at the time, expressing her concern and her desire that, of course, the horse not be placed in quarantine for any extended period of time. And she threw in a line about, if you quarantine this horse for a very long time, the people who love animals are never going to vote for you again.
So, that did it.
Yeah, that apparently did it. I said to myself, I am sure he's just sitting there laughing, but he'll give in, and he did.
And what happened to the tiger cubs?
Well, the first two that were given died before we could bring them back to the States.
Oh.
And as I recall, the second two, I think, were brought to the United States and placed in the zoo. At first, she thought maybe they could be on the south grounds of the White House.
Yeah, right.
That's not a very good idea.
Oh, I don't know. It might be fun to look at, a little zoo there. So how has this whole talking about all of this been for you? Has it been hard or not?
It's been very cathartic, very beneficial.
Good.
I really appreciate the fact that I've had the chance to do that, to talk to the people and to talk to people like you, through your radio.
Well, good. I'm delighted you wrote the book. I just think it's an important book, and it's just so honest. It's just an honest, dignified book, much as you sound like to me after this hour. It's just, I really liked it. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you did. I hope other people do as well.
I'm sure they will. Thank you, Clint Hill, for being with us. Our guest this hour, Clint Hill, Special Agent, United States Secret Service. His book, which is already bestseller, Mrs. Kennedy and Me. And it really is. It's for those of you who want to know more about that time in American history, you weren't alive, or you would like to know about Jackie Kennedy and her travels and who she was, it's an interesting piece of American history. It ends horrifically, as you know. You know the end of the story, but this is maybe the part that you don't know as well. He was her Secret Service agent from the whole time, for the whole time she was First Lady of the United States, and then for a year after the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for your calls and for listening, everybody. Be with you again tomorrow when we'll do some comedy. Complete change. Great conversations ahead.